So when you think about relatives, what comes to mind? Well, there are pleasant thoughts for those relatives that we like. And then there are maybe some other interesting responses with regard to some other relatives. You know, you've heard it said, you can choose your friends, but you're stuck with your relatives. Well, when you think about it, we're all related. So we're all relatives, but there are some that are closer than others. And we've been looking at the book of Isaiah, and we have seen some judgments in the last couple of chapters. And we saw last time that God's judgment is given for a purpose, and it referenced several times, "I'm purposing to do this." And so there was reference to Babylon, chapters 13 and the bulk of chapter 14, focused on the city of Babylon, then expanded a little bit to Assyria, because Assyria was over Babylon at that time, though wouldn't continue to be so. But one of the things that was communicated there was that the ordering of history, even with all of the chaos and things that are going on, is sufficiently organized that we can see that God's people are cared for through that process. And so part of God's purpose is he is directing things toward a particular end that he has in mind. And ultimately, we see God is in control. And we saw that last time as well. When we think about the oracle related to Philistia, it was a similar thing, and noting also that the promises that were made with regard to David and his throne and those details that are yet coming, those things are sure. And then chapters 15 and 16, now we're going to be dealing with Moab. And that's not the city in Utah, for those of us who are more familiar with this part of the country. So we need to be thinking about, okay, what is Moab all about? As we think about Babylon, you know, it was going to be a world power. We think about Assyria, it was a world power. But Moab wasn't. But it was still noteworthy enough for two chapters at this point, and we'll see Jeremiah also references Moab, as do others at various times. So there must be something there, and we see there's a little bit of a different relationship with Moab. So we want to be thinking about that. But we want to be thinking about the background. Some details might be helpful for us to keep in mind. And we want to think about, for instance, Moab's origin. And this goes back to the time of Abraham and Lot. And you recall after Lot and some of his family escaped from Sodom, that they ended up living in a cave. And then we have this incestuous situation that comes to pass. As noted in Genesis 19, verse 37, we read, "The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day." So that's the connection there. An ancestor, basically, of Lot, and therefore tied to Abraham, and therefore there is this closeness of relationship. And they're also closely related by proximity, the location. And if you can see this map, which may not be so easy to see, or if you look at the front of your bulletin, which nicely has a map on it, you can see here's the Dead Sea, here is the kingdom of Judah, here is the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, here up here is kingdom of Aram, Damascus, or Syria, and this is Ammon, the other progeny of Lot, and then this is the kingdom of Moab right here. And probably the reason that Moab, Utah, is called Moab is because it looks a little bit like what it looks like in the region of Moab, the ancient territory here. But it's just across this little pond here. It's actually more than a little pond. It's fairly desolate around that area. as a matter of fact. But it's not a very large area. It's between a couple of rivers, the Arnon and the Zered rivers. And the main area is roughly 30 miles by 30 miles, so it's not a real huge area. Of course, all of Palestine, what we have been referring to Palestine, the Holy Land, or Israel is the probably better term, or Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, is not very large. So small area. So you wonder, why bother with this? So we need to think about Moab's relation to and treatment of Israel. How did they get along? What was the relationship that there would be a couple of chapters related to this people? Well, one of the things that we note is that the Moabites were generally more friendly neighbors of Judah than the Edomites or the Ammonites, who also lived on the other side of the Jordan or the Dead Sea there. And in a sense, if you kind of read it somewhat more carefully, you'll notice there's a slightly more friendly tone in this oracle regarding Moab than what there was in the previous ones. And it becomes quite obvious in a couple of places. But the hostility that existed between Judah and Moab had largely to do with land claims and just generally fighting over territory, sometimes over just having power or authority or so on. Also, there's a text to note, and I want to just take a look. If you have your Bibles, you can turn to Zephaniah 2, 9, and 10. I just want to see if you can find Zephaniah. It's just before Haggai, which is just before Zechariah, which is just before Malachi, which is just before Matthew. I'm giving you time to find it. Zephaniah chapter 2, beginning at verse 9. So Zephaniah is writing a bit later than what Isaiah was. So you'll see this is still something that has continued future implications. Therefore, as I live, says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be like Sodom, which reminds you of the connection of its origin, and the people of Ammon like Gomorrah, Ammon also related, overrun with weeds and salt pits. Well, that sounds like Albuquerque these days. I don't know about the salt pits, but the weeds certainly are taking hold well. And a perpetual desolation. The residue of my people shall plunder them, and the remnant of my people shall possess them. This they shall have for their pride, because they have reproached and made arrogant threats against the people of the Lord of hosts. So there is a reference to the problem and the result. And we'll see this is an ongoing thing, and it certainly is worthy of noting. The point of the oracle, as with these others, and as we had pointed out previously, going all the way back to chapter 7 of Isaiah, was where are you looking for help, Israel or Judah? Are you looking to Babylon? Are you looking to Assyria? You could add in there Egypt, eventually dealt with as well. Or Moab, are you looking to align yourself with them? No, you need to be trusting in the Lord, because Moab is going to suffer destruction. Don't trust in Moab, because it has its own problems. So let's take a quick look at then a survey of some passages that indicates the relations of these nations. And I'm not going to read all of these. I'm just going to give you a summation, but I'll note the passage so you can get a picture, because you need to be thinking, you know, you need to have an idea of who is this Moab? What is the relationship here? So after some of the initial references, then we look at Numbers 21, 26 to 30, we see that Moab suffered defeat at the hands of the Amorites. So Moab, like other nations, you know, had wars with various peoples around. And then Numbers 22, verse 3, Moab was afraid of Israel. This was when Balak was the king of Moab, chapter 22, verse 4. Number 33:50, Israel camped in the plains of Moab before entering Canaan. So that's where they came through, and it was sort of their launching point to go across the Jordan River. Deuteronomy 2:9, the Lord told Israel not to harass Moab. Deuteronomy 34:5, Moses died in the land of Moab. So you see many different connections there. Joshua 24:9, Balak, the king of Moab, arose to make war against Israel. Judges 3:14, Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years till the judge Ehud came up and took care of Eglon. And you think about the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1 through 6 and verse 22, Ruth was a Moabitess, yet she was in the Messianic line. A whole another issue to be considered. 1 Samuel 12:9, Moab and others fought against Israel. 1 Samuel 14:47, Saul fought against Moab and others. 2 Samuel 8:2, David subdued Moab, and they brought tribute to him. And here's a good one. 1 Kings 11:7, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the god of Moab. I thought Solomon was the wisest man. That doesn't sound like a real wise thing. He had issues as well. Or 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 1 and 3:5, Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. 2 Kings 13:20, when Elisha died, raiding bands of Moabites invaded the land of Israel in the spring of the year. It's just a sampling of many of the different occasions where there was interaction between Israel, the land of Israel, and Moab. Most of it was not so good. And it may be another one of those indications, going back to Genesis chapter 12, those who bless Israel and treat Israel well, it will go well with them. Those who do not, it will not go well with them, hence the judgment that ensues. So one of the things that we see then in looking at this nation is they were clearly on the naughty list. I thought I would use some colloquial terminology that you can all relate to, even if it is a little goofy. So looking at verses 1 through 2 of this first chapter that we're looking at with regard to Moab, chapter 15, beginning at verse 1, the burden against Moab. So that tells you something right there. This is a word from the Lord, and it is against Moab. That's not a positive statement. Because in the night, Ar of Moab is laid waste and destroyed. Because in the night, Kir of Moab is laid waste and destroyed. He has gone up to the temple and Dibon, to the high places to weep. Moab will wail over Nebo and Medeba. And so this is an indication, because of the devastation that's going to be taking place, the people are going to go up to their temple and seek some consolation, explanation, help, hope, something. On all their heads will be baldness and every beard cut off. That's the typical mourning kind of exhibition. Verse 3, in their streets they will clothe themselves with sackcloth on the tops of their houses, and in their streets everyone will wail, weeping bitterly. Heshbon and Elealeh will cry out. Their voice shall be heard as far as Jahaz. Therefore the armed soldiers of Moab will cry out. His life will be burdensome to him, which communicates an element of hopelessness. So some observations to make here. They would experience physical and emotional trauma. That's pretty evident in just looking at the text on the surface. There would be manifold indications of destruction. It doesn't go into great detail there, but it expands on a little bit more, but notes a few things that are worthy of recognizing here. But the indication is that there would be certain ruin that is coming. It's going to be swift, as in indicating in the night, and perhaps when they're not expecting it. And there are two main cities that are referenced here. Ar was on the Arnon River, and Kir was in central Moab, but they would fall quickly, is the indication. Then there would be manifold indications of distress. When your country is taken over, when you face war, something we've seen almost nothing of personally. We've only seen it in other places, but we can imagine the horror and the helplessness that one feels in that kind of a situation. So the result would be that the Moabites would express great grief over their national defeat. And so they would do what one does. One seeks their God. Isn't that what we do when we face distress? Dibon was the site of the temple of the Moabite god Chemosh. And the many people would want to say, okay, Chemosh, save us. What's going on? Why this happened to us? Why did you let... I mean, the typical kinds of things that we would expect. They would also mourn the loss of the towns of Nebo and Medeba in the typical fashion of the day, as we've noted. And the residents of Heshbon and Elilah in North Moab could be heard wailing as far south as Jahaz in that region. So it's just giving an idea, try to give a graphic description of the chaos, the distress, the frustration, and the hurt that there, and even the soldiers would experience some element of despair. That's the picture. There's a loss of hope, a loss of well-being. The situation is dire. And it points out the hopelessness of a life that's lived against God. Now, they had their idea of what a God was with Chemosh, but they were against God. They had, at some point in their time, even though they would have been aware of the true God because of the connection with Israel, because they were familiar, even when Israel came out of Egypt and came through, and the land as a whole was in a panic because they had heard what their God had done to get them to that point. And they used Moab as a launching pad to go into the land of Canaan. And so they would have been familiar, but they did not accept the true God. They held tenaciously to their own form and understanding of God. Kind of sounds like today. We have an awareness as a society of a God, though that is fading fast. But what we recognize is a rejection, an ignorance, a defaming, a ridicule of anything to do with the true God today. And you see it all around us. And it should be a sobering lesson, because we know that that's not going to end well. It didn't end well here. It's not going to end well in our time, in our culture as well. Then looking at verses 5 through 7 of chapter 15, my heart will cry out for Moab. Now that's an interesting statement right there, because there's an element of concern that's communicated here. His fugitives will flee to Zoar like a three-year-old heifer. That's what it says in the King James, New King James. In the NASB, it is Iglath-Shelishiah. Well, it's not as quite as easy to say, but it's probably more accurate. it's a place, probably not, though there's only one letter difference in the translation there. For by the ascent of Luhith they will go up with weeping, for in the way of Horonaim they will raise up a cry of destruction, for the waters of Nimrim will be desolate, for the green grass has withered away, the grass fails, there is nothing green. Obviously some physical kind of destruction is pictured there. Therefore the abundance they have gained and what they have laid up they will carry away to the brook of the willows. One of the translations on that. For the cry has gone all around the borders of Moab, its wailing to Eglaim and its wailing to Beer Elim. For the waters of Dimon will be full of blood, because I will bring upon Dimon lions, upon him who escapes from Moab and on the remnant of the land. I forgot to push the button so you could see it. So what should we note here? The impact of this judgment would be lamentable. So the first thing we note here is, of course, Isaiah is communicating this from what he got from the Lord. And so he's communicating the Lord's grief over judgment on men. It's interesting to think about the Lord expressing grief over the coming judgment on Moab. And Isaiah is communicating his heart and the heart of the Lord over this distress, this concern. And he is speaking essentially in behalf of the Lord as he's doing so. And so there's a sensitivity, a concern. And there should be a lesson in this for us as well, to think of the Lord and Isaiah expressing distress over the judgment that's coming on people. Sometimes we have a sense of that same kind of concern for judgment that's coming, but sometimes we may not. Sometimes we may think, well, they get what's coming to them. And yet we need to have a proper balance and understanding of that. What is our level of concern for the judgment that's coming due to sin and the ultimate destiny that people face? Are we concerned about the fate of the lost, of the lost world? That's a good reminder for us. Then there are many specific locations that are mentioned in this text. Zoar is mentioned. It was the northernmost Edomite city, so they would have apparently fled somewhat south towards Edom, which would seem to indicate that the coming judgment would be coming from the north, and if associated with Assyria, as it's generally so, at least some of the times that are noted, they would have been fleeing to get away from that, which is very typical of any of the places of the world where there has been war and the people flee to get away from that. They go as quickly as far as they can and end up in a refugee kind of situation. That's somewhat the picture that is communicated here. This is a general indication of great insecurity and terror. The Moabite refugees move from place to place trying to find security. Where they had been in a place of self-reliance, confidence in what they are able to provide, now they're finding themselves in a very insecure situation. And it sort of causes us to think about all the peoples of the world in the various countries around the world where we have a tendency as our individual nationalistic kind of thinking, that we are in control, we can handle things. I mean, all you have to do is think about North Korea. They've really got it together. The people are in dire straits almost all the time for the pride and arrogance of a few who are leading. And that's not atypical. I mean, they are a standout, but that attitude, that mindset seems to be typical. And that's what's pictured, as we see here as well. Whatever false type of security is very tenuous and very uncertain, and particularly when you think about, well, who is ultimately in control and how will he deal with that, the one who is in control. And so the picture is, when the Lord removes his hand of security and he sends judgment, the results are devastating. And you can count on the devastation that's going to take place. You've been forewarned. You should have known better. Romans chapter 1 reminds us that which is known of God is evident, and no one is without excuse. That applies as well. And again, we have to come back to our own nation. Where are we? What is our attitude? What is our disposition? It just reminds us that the problem of sin is universal. And the matter of judgment is also universal. Sin must be dealt with. And the only solution is acceptance of the provision that God makes available through Christ. So the nation was in serious need of refuge. So we read in verse 1 of chapter 16, "Send the lamb to the ruler of the land." That's a picture of tribute there. "From Selah," or Petra, "to the wilderness, to the mount of the daughter of Zion." That's the place. So the picture here is, send tribute to Zion, to God's people, to Israel. That's where their hope is going to be, because it's going to be found in their God. "For it shall be as a wandering bird thrown out of the nest, so shall the daughters of Moab, so shall be the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon," that's the river there. "Take counsel, execute judgment." And you'll notice the quotation mark here. This is a statement. This verse and the next two go together. "Take counsel, execute judgment. Make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. Hide the outcast. Do not betray him who escapes. Let my outcast dwell with you." And I think this is an interjection from Isaiah. "O Moab, be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end. Devastation ceases. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. In mercy, the throne will be established. The one who will sit on it in truth, in the tabernacle of David." Now notice the reference there. Who is this talking about? The throne will be established. The one who will sit on it will sit in truth in the tabernacle of David. There's a particular context. "Judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness." So here we have an anticipation that focuses on the kingdom when Christ is reigning on the throne in the place of David. So it often takes distress to cause one to seek help. Well, and judgment will do that. But we've also noted that judgment and salvation go together. And the reason salvation is needed is because judgment is taking place. And they needed salvation in a physical sense, but more so in a spiritual sense, as they were dealing with the judgment that was coming upon them. So we want to take a moment here and recognize the vulnerability in this poetic imagery. This indicates that Moab would plead for shelter from her enemy. Her leaders would send a lamb as a tribute from their hiding place in some wilderness stronghold. It's assumed this probably this reference to Selah in Edom, Petra, to the king of Judah requesting help. And the Moabite refugees would be as frightened as birds while they hovered on their border, and they would seek refuge in Judah. Because again, it's the picture that we see over and over again on the news of people who are displaced because of war that's in their nations. We've seen it all over the Middle East, in Africa, Asia. It's just been all over. Well, we see it over in our neck of the woods, but it's usually associated with drug lords taking over an area. And then Isaiah projects Moab's request in verses 3 through 5. He's basically projecting on them what they will or should respond in seeking to have some security provided from Judah. Now, normally when we think about Judah, we think, well, Judah was rather up in the air at this time in terms of, was it really a place where you would go to for help? They were dealing with some of the same problems that Moab was dealing with in terms of invading nations. They were having to deal with Assyria and all of that. But this is also anticipating the future, what was to be coming, because these judgments, for one thing, would be coming later, but also it's anticipating a more distant future, that is the millennial kingdom that's coming. But Judah did dodge a previous invasion when Assyria was surrounding Jerusalem, and the Lord intervened directly by the angel of the Lord coming and killing 185,000 of the Assyrians. So there was a sense in which if you're going to go somewhere where the hand of the Lord is upon the people. Don't go somewhere else. And that's the picture that they needed to keep in mind. But you think about Israel, Judah, the Jews today. Do you think about them as these are the people to go to? These are the people where you can find refuge. These are the people where you're going to find help and hope. Well, that's not the picture that you get today. Most everybody is turned against them in a very powerful and strong way. They are the object of scorn and derision. They are seen as the problem. They are seen as the instigators of all the trouble in the Middle East. But that's not reality. That's a perception that has been perpetuated by none other than the devil himself. And that is the only explanation that can explain why there is such a hatred for the Jews. And we were reminded of that again in the Sunday school hour as we saw the videos that are communicating that problem as it relates to the connection even between the Nazis and Islam. But that's another whole issue. So this is ultimately fulfilled in the millennium. That's the picture that's communicated here. The future hope is going to be found in its Davidic king. And so while there may be some more near elements of connection and hope, there's this ultimate looking down the road to the ultimate provision when Judah trusts in their Messiah, when Israel wholeheartedly as a people embrace their Messiah, then they will be recognized as they are the ones to go to because they are rightly related to the God of the universe. And the Messiah is reigning in Jerusalem. So that's a future picture. And Scripture tells us in various places that the nations will be drawn to that land, to Israel at that time. So this provided really a significant hope for both Israel and Moab. So if you recognize that, you can see, well, this was to be an encouragement for Israel, but also for Moab, at least in the more distant future. But it doesn't get them off the hook, because there's a problem. And the problem is, in that one word, pride. Verse 6 through 8, we have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath. But his lies shall not be so. Therefore Moab shall wail for Moab. They will recognize that they've got some problems to have to deal with. Everyone shall wail. For the foundations of Kir Hareseth you shall mourn. Surely they are stricken. For the fields of Heshbon languish. The vine of Sibmah. The lords of the nations have broken down its choice plants. That's suggesting the invasion perhaps associated with Assyria. Which have reached to Jazer and wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out. They are gone over the sea. Well, one of the things that we readily recognize is the effects of pride and arrogance always impact life negatively. And yet, we are so prone as a people, fallen people, to pride and arrogance. Thinking we can handle things. We have everything under control. We don't need anything or anybody else. We can just do things on our own. The recurring problem of pride results in judgment, and we see that in Scripture over and over again. We've seen it with the various references earlier in the book of Isaiah, and it's a continuing thing. And it affects one's relationship with God. Because you're not trusting him, you're trusting yourself. And that brings judgment, so that's a problem. It affects one's relationship with others because you have an attitude that we are superior or something comparable, and you see everyone else as inferior, and you treat them accordingly. The effects of judgment include serious grief. Moab's excessive pride and arrogance and insolence were the reason for the invasion that was going to be coming upon them, and the invader is the instrument of God, referenced again in chapter 13, verse 11. And so again, it's a wake-up call for all nations, because there it's a general, common response that people have to act in that way. And you don't have to work it up. It seems to come pretty easily. And every people needs to deal with that. And we're in that situation. And that's the disturbing thing, as we see this, these various oracles that are given in this book, we can't help but see the parallels with our own time, with our own nation, and the nations around us that are, for all intents and purposes, in the same situation and can anticipate a similar kind of response. So it's a wake-up call, or should be. And there was really no basis for Moab to be boasting, to be thinking that it was in control. Now, there's some imagery that's used here with regard to the grapevine. Moab had a lot of grapevines, and they were known for that. The picture is that Moab had extended beyond its boundaries with influence, and it was known to have distributed raisin cakes. And you see raisin cakes referenced many times in Scripture, 1 Chronicles 12:40, Hosea 3:1. It was sort of a delicacy that was noted, and it was something that they were known for providing. But that was going to be coming to a disruption, to say the least. And so what this indicates is ultimately some severe economic devastation. And one of the interesting things about people is that their most sensitive area is the wallet. And when you touch that, then you get their attention. And I'm sure you have observed that, perhaps in your own experience, because we know people vote by their wallet. They vote according to what's going to give me the most, without regard necessarily to the moral correctness of a particular thing. So when this kind of thing, as is referenced here, happens and you mess with the economy, then you eventually get people's attention. And we have seen that in our own nation as well. Then coming to the last portion here, beginning at verse 9, "Therefore I will bewail the vine of Sibmah with the weeping of Jazer. I will drench you with my tears." And here again is Isaiah speaking for the Lord of a concern, a compassion. "O Heshbon and Elealeh, for battle cries have fallen over your summer fruits and your harvest. Gladness is taken away, and joy from the plentiful field. In the vineyards there will be no singing, nor will there be shouting. No treaders will tread out wine in the presses. I have made their shouting cease." So again, just an indication, looking at the very specific, tangible production of the nation that is going to be disrupted, and this is going to get to them like perhaps a lot of other things don't. "Therefore my heart will resound like a harp for Moab, and my inner being for Kir Haris." Again, talking about specific locations and the reality and implication of this. "And it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place." What are the high places about? That's their places of worship, worshiping their idols. "That he will come to his sanctuary to pray, but he will not prevail," because he's going to a false god. "This is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning Moab since that time." So here we have a notation that this is a further word beyond what he had previously received. This Isaiah, again speaking. "But now the Lord has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hired man, the glory of Moab will be despised with all that great multitude, and the remnant will be very small and feeble." And so, in spite of the reference to concern and compassion, the judgment is sure and certain, and it's coming, and look out. The devastation coming on this nation will result in lament. A lament that Isaiah communicates in behalf of him and the Lord, but also among the people themselves. So even the Lord will grieve over Moab's judgment. Even when he must judge people, the Lord has pity on them and grieves over the destruction that he sends. Hosea 11, 1-9 communicates a parallel idea. The joy that the people of Moab would have had because of their production associated with grapes in particular, that would be destroyed. And therefore, all the production and the things associated with it, the gladness, the singing, the shouting, all that would be gone. And that would cause the heart of the Lord to be concerned for them, even in their pride. But even though he has concern, it's not going to remove the judgment. It's still coming. And that's the issue. The expression of divine concern did not nullify the coming judgment. So the ruin is going to be imminent. It is going to take place as a hired man is counting down his 3 years to go day by day. The Judeans would do the same as they anticipate the degrading of Moab's glory and population, what was going to be coming to them. And it has been pointed out that the fulfillment of this destruction on Moab came, and it could be associated either with one or another of either between 715 and 713 BC, or possibly with Sennacherib destroying it in 701 BC. Both of those certainly would fit. One commentator said this with regard to this passage. He said, "The grief of the judge of all the earth is one of the two striking truths of this oracle. The other is that all this total loss and suffering arises from the single sin of pride." So we have something that references the compassionate heart of the Lord, and something else that notes how sobering the reality of sin, particularly the sin of pride, and that heart that doesn't want to come to the Lord but wants to trust in itself. And we have to deal with that as individuals, personally, because we can be characterized by the same thing. We have our moments when we trust in ourselves rather than the Lord. And so this is a reminder that we need to trust in him, and that's what the text in Isaiah constantly comes back to. Are you trusting him? Are you trusting him rather than other things?